You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 20th of January 2017 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Tuck. On today's show...
This is your day. This is your celebration. And this, the United States of America, is your country. From this day forward, it's going to be only America first. America first.
Donald Trump is sworn in as US president. My guests, Monocle's Steve Bloomfield and Daniel Giacopelli, will be discussing the events of the day here with me in the studio, with contributions from Ed Stocker in Washington, D.C., and Thomas Lewis in Philadelphia. We'll also be looking at the challenges ahead for the US nation.
I think the United States is facing a real existential crisis.
And we'll be asking, who are the new first family? That's all to come on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. So welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Steve Bloomfield and Daniel Giacopelli. They didn't have to come far. Well, welcome both to the programme. An hour ago, Donald Trump was inaugurated as the 45th president of the United States. Monocle's Ed Stocker is in Washington, D.C., and we'll hear from him in a moment. But first, let's hear a little of what Donald Trump had to say in his first speech as leader of the world's largest superpower.
For too long, a small group in our nation's capital has reaped the rewards of government while the people have borne the cost. That all changes, starting right here and right now, because this moment is your moment, it belongs to you. And your dreams will define our American destiny. And your courage and goodness and love will forever guide us along the way. Together, we will make America strong again. We will make America wealthy again. We will make America proud again. We will make America safe again. And yes, together, we will make America great again. Thank you, God bless you, and God bless America.
The new president of the United States, Donald Trump. Well, we have Ed Stocker on the line now, normally in our New York bureau, of course, but in Washington, D.C. today for the inauguration. Thank you for joining us, Ed. Just first of all, give us some sense of who was there in the sense of the crowds and the atmosphere. Bring it to life for us.
Sure. The people I've been talking to before the inauguration and also just now, I'm in fact just walking out as we speak from the inauguration with all the crowds, a lot of Make America Great Again hats. People have come from all over, from Idaho to Texas, people, you know, who felt inspired by Donald Trump's message, have, you know, wanted to get themselves tickets and come down. From where I was actually seated, quite near the front, I couldn't really, it was quite hard for me to see, you know, the full extent of how many people were in the mall, but some aerial pictures I saw suggested it was maybe perhaps less full than the previous inauguration, but I haven't been able to confirm that. But, you know, there's a lot of chanting, a lot of Trump shouts from some of the people who were standing slightly further back, some also shouts of USA. Some elements of the crowd weren't too happy when Chuck Schumer was speaking, but everyone who's walking out now when asked seems to be saying that they're positive about a future with Donald J. Trump, yes, really, as 45th president of the US.
Now, it would be fair to say, and it's a very hard act to follow, that he is not an orator like President Obama, but does his oration, did you feel it kind of sparked enough in the crowd? Because in many ways, perhaps, you know, for some of the American audience who didn't vote for Hillary, you know, the narration of someone like Obama doesn't quite kind of excite them. It's too clever, it's too beautiful, it's too removed from their lives. Do you think that you felt, you know, that kind of sense of pride and excitement building up as he spoke?
I mean, you know, America is so divided right now. So, you know, the majority of the people who are in the crowd, he completely played to that crowd, you know. He essentially brought up the same issues that he's mentioned all throughout his campaign. And the biggest cheer that I heard anyway was when he mentioned, of course, radical Islamic terrorism. That got a huge cheer from everyone around me, talking about the borders, talking about bringing jobs back. You know, these are themes that we've heard for the last months and months of his campaign. So perhaps I was expecting him to change tack slightly, but I think he delivered, I guess, the same sort of message that to people who don't support him would, you know, call dystopian or pessimistic. To supporters, it's just saying it how it is and telling the truth about America and what needs to change. I mean, there was a slight change. One felt that he did try to kind of be slightly more positive in some aspects when he talked about whether you were black, brown or white, you know, that, you know, all Americans bleed that same blood, red blood of patriots. That perhaps was a move to try and sound a more uniting front. But I guess some people who oppose him will say that he could have done more to unify what is a very polarized country still.
Yeah, and just before we move on, Ed, it would be interesting if President Obama had been doing that. His list of categories, I think, would have gone further. He would have mentioned gay people. He would have mentioned, you know, many more groups of people. He would have mentioned, for sure, Muslims and Jews and people of religious faith. Yeah. And as he did in his famous speech before, even people without faith. You know, so it was a very short list of, you know, if you're trying to be inclusive. But Ed, we're going to let you go because we're going to dive back here to the studio where I'm joined by Steve Bloomfield, Monocle's executive editor, and also by Monocle 24's Daniel Giacopelli, of course, an American with some views on what's been happening. Steve, first of all, the speech. What did you make of it?
I've never heard a speech that is at once awful and terrifying, and yet this was it. As a speech, it was surreal in places. That was the paragraphs didn't seem to flow together. But what's more worrying is what he said. He talked about America first. He said, we'll have a motto, buy American, hire American. And now, of course, you know, we can all point out his inconsistencies. Buy American, hire American is a policy that Donald Trump may say, but he certainly doesn't do himself in his own industries. He talked about protectionism. This was a very nationalist speech. Let's not make any bones about this. This was a speech that you would have heard in the 18th century, in the 19th century. It was not a speech about the role that America plays in the world. It was not a speech that would make any of America's allies happy at all. And in fact, to such an extent that one wonders now whether any of America's traditional allies will actually see America as an ally at all, or just as a country to be wary of and try not to offend. And it was a speech that was full of contradictions. He talked about how he is now for the people. He suggested, he talked in quite conspiratorial tones, saying, as we heard in that clip, that for too long, a small group of people in Washington has reaped the rewards of government while ordinary people have borne the cost, as if this was some sort of kleptocratic dictatorship that he's overthrown and now finally will have democracy. It was bizarre.
So let's just, before we bring it down here, just on some of those points, because let me be, you know, the counter-argument. In the sense of, you know, put America first, he also did say that is the job of every country, is to feel that they should put themselves first. And although it may come across with a bit more rhetoric than in some places, you know, I remember here in the UK, you know, 20, 30 years ago, there used to be a campaign, you know, buy British. It was encouraging people to turn over a product and see where it was made and only buy things that were made in the UK because our industries were collapsing. And he feels that he's answering to a constituency that feels the same thing. So is there anything wrong with saying, you know, turn it over, see if it's made in America?
In a sense, no. It's understandable But there is a problem when you live in a world where you want to trade with other nations, and where the economy survives if only if we trade with other nations. And it's also problematic when you have an economy that relies so much on buying things from elsewhere. It's, you know, he talks about American cars. Well, you know, and he's trying to put pressure on BMW to make its cars in America. Well, lots of those parts come from Germany. They come from elsewhere. If you're going to put a 35% tariff on those parts, then you're going to make products more expensive for American consumers. And that's the thing about trade that he doesn't seem to understand, or he does in his business, but not in his politics, is that trade makes things cheaper for everyone. It makes things cheaper. So by all means, close the borders, only make stuff in your own country, only sell stuff in your own country, but everything will be more expensive.
Danny, there's lots of people I could be picking up there and quizzing Steve on. I think certainly Mr. Trump would have some comebacks. But you're an American, you're from New York State, you've been living in Europe a long time, you have both the perspective of an American and somebody looking from a distance. Do you understand who he's trying to connect with, and how effective did you think that speech was at doing that?
Well, yeah, I mean, I understand who he's trying to connect with, but I think his job is already done. I mean, he's not going to gain any more supporters than he already has. He's kind of reached, I think he's reached a ceiling of supporters.
And we should point out he has some of the lowest ratings for any incoming
the
president.
Lowest, yeah. The lowest ever.
Yeah, the lowest ever. I mean, and I highly doubt he's going to get any more supporters. If anything, he's going to lose them. So right now, he's just trying to maintain the campaign rhetoric. I mean, what we just saw was a campaign speech. I didn't find that uniting whatsoever. It was an aggressive speech. It was very, not violent, but I mean, you know, the way he spoke was not a uniter. I mean, he kept seeing the shot of Obama, you know, he kept panning to Obama. I mean, what must he be thinking when he's watching Trump kind of rip apart his legacy?
What did you think, of his, Steve's right in the sense that it was interesting. It was a speech that could have been from, from the period, after the Great Depression, when you're talking about a New Deal, and here was somebody saying we're going to build railroads and roads,
which is great.
Yeah,
if he does it, I mean, that would make jobs. I mean, let's not be, America's infrastructure is crumbling; it's complete crap. I mean, bridges are falling down, roads are crap. We need, massive infrastructure
and also,
projects.
And you're right, but that's also not a new idea, and it's something that Barack Obama tried to do over 8 years, but the Republican Congress blocked him at every turn. So, and this is one of the interesting things for Democrats, over the next 4 years is, do they support Donald Trump when he is trying to do things like infrastructure, if he actually does try to do them?
But here's, but Danny, a good point, because here's a point where, we find many things we can, I think here at Monocle, we can disagree with Mr. Trump on, or President Trump, as I should call him now. But one of the things that he talked about during the campaign was, which something resonated with us, was he said, Americans go through American airports and they think, how come we don't have as airports as good as you find, for example, in China? What is going on here? Now, there's many answers to that question. But he's right at putting out that, maybe there were some blockages here and there. But in the end, American infrastructure didn't change dramatically. So here's something he could do that could be pretty good.
He's a builder. I mean, that's his thing. He's been building his entire life. And listen, if he does that, then God bless him. But I mean, I doubt he's going to do it. Also because what he said and what the Republicans want are often very different things.
And also what he says today is very different from what he might say another day.
I mean, healthcare is just one thing on that. Yeah. I mean, he said, the Republicans want nothing to do with universal healthcare, but Trump said everybody will be covered under his plan. Well, which is it?
Can I just go back to something Danny said about his popularity and how he spoke today? What's interesting is that American presidents normally, from the moment they're elected, they try to bring people together. And so, for example, this time 8 years ago, the night before the inauguration, Barack Obama hosted a dinner for John McCain, the man that he had beaten. And To do with that and many other reasons, Barack Obama came into office with much higher approval ratings than even the number of people that voted for him. And what was striking about Donald Trump's speech today, and why I think it was politically not very smart, was that there was no attempt to reach out to people who didn't vote for him. That's something very, very new for America. I'm struggling to think, Danny, of any American president who's come in not making any attempt whatsoever to reach over to people who opposed him.
Yeah, I mean, he said, the usual kind of, I'll be a president for all Americans kind of stuff. I mean, but that's as most as he said.
But what's interesting, we need to move on a second, but what's interesting is, you know, the trappings that get wrapped around you as an individual when you become president. So, you know, the speeches that happened before, you know, the sopranos, the choirs, the hullabaloo, the setting, they kind of make him a president. You know, even if you're lacking elsewhere. So we can pick apart his speech and say that he hasn't met some of those points, and, you know, maybe he didn't, you know, reach across the American aisle, as it were. But in the end, you can't help but look quite presidential in that situation.
It's all surface level stuff, though. I mean, you'll see day one, it'll be, oh my God, what am I doing? What have I done?
Well, that's what liberals hope.
When the weight of governance is on your shoulders, if he actually does try to govern, that'll be a different story than standing up in front of, you know, hundreds of thousands of people.
Or hand over to Mike Pence. Yeah.
But I think, Andrew, you've got a point. And actually, if he had tried to reach out, if he had been more conciliatory, if, for example, he had decided to go for lunch with Hillary Clinton and sort of make a show of reaching out, and then on top of that you add all the pomp and circumstance, and, you know, America likes to come together and this is a big event and it's the inaugural address, the inauguration, you add all that together and he could have been much more popular than he is so far.
That's a good point.
Well, we're going to listen now to a thought from the US author and commentator Ben Fountain. He'll be on this Sunday's Monocle Weekly for an in-depth chat about the direction of the US in the Trump era. In this excerpt from the chat, Ben explains why he thinks the road ahead for the US will be a very challenging one.
I think the United States is facing a real existential crisis on the order of, all right, the United States has had two genuine existential crises before in its history: the Civil War, which resulted in the abolition of slavery, and the Great Depression, which resulted in the United States remaking itself as a social democratic society. This third existential crisis that's coming, I mean, the United States is going to have to decide, are we going to remake ourselves and survive as a plausibly authentic constitutional democracy, or are we going to become something else? There will still be a United States, but whether it's an authentic constitutional democracy, I think that's the real question. And I think we'll be facing that crisis in a very direct way in a couple of years.
Author Ben Fountain there. Steve, he says the US is facing an existential crisis. Do you think that's overstating it, or do you think that cuts to the truth?
I don't think it's overstating it, no. And I think there is a, you know, as we've discussed a lot over the last year, there is a crisis of democracy, and particularly of liberal democracy, which seems to be slightly falling apart at the seams. And it's important to remember that, you know, democracy is quite a recent experiment, particularly liberal democracy. The norms that we take for granted can very easily be undercut. So, for example, the Fourth Estate, the media. You know, 20 years ago, it was expected that, you know, the media was an important part of how a democracy functioned. Now we have a president who refuses to give press conferences, who refuses to have the press follow him around, who will perhaps even get rid of the press office within the White House. And you see that these things can come apart very, very quickly unless people push back. A lot of those things that we take for granted can disappear. And the question is, what do you do to ensure that doesn't happen? And I think, as we've seen in this country, for those that were concerned over Brexit, and we'll see in the US post Trump's election, that if you are concerned about something, if you're angry about something, you have to come together and you have to form coalitions and you have to fight back in some way.
Ben Fountain there suggesting, Danny, that you know, the idea of America remaining a constitutional democracy is not a given. And you know, it's easy to dismiss that as you know, crazy. And we know that the Constitution is something you can go back to again and again, and it kind of informs and continues to hold in place many of the liberties that Americans hold rightfully dear. But what's interesting is Donald Trump has done many spectacular things in recent months. And one of the things is he's tapped into this audience who just don't care about how things should be done or were done before and are not that interested in anyone else's rights, to be fair. Do you think that he has found potentially an audience who wouldn't care if there wasn't so much constitutional democracy around?
If they didn't care about the type of government that they were living under.
Yeah, well, are they that wedded to the notion of democratic values and the rights of all?
Yes, I think they are, but I think they don't necessarily know. I mean, if you ask the average American on the street, you know, what's the makeup of the government? You know, what are the two houses called? How do things work? How does a bill become a law? Most of them wouldn't know, not well, just out
be,
of sheer ignorance.
That would be the same in UK and in France and
well, right.
Liechtenstein,
but
sure.
They are fiercely democratic. I mean, which is, of course, has all been completely undermined by this bizarre fascination with Vladimir Putin and the strongman kind of type of government. But Americans are severely democratic. I mean, they believe in democracy. They don't want to be ruled by a strongman.
But they believe in the word democracy. And this isn't to criticize Americans. I think this is the problem generally, is that actually, you know, over the last 2-3 generations, we haven't had to choose between liberalism and democracy. We can have both together, and you can have, on the whole, growing economies and democracy together. Now, what if you have to choose between the two? And the moment that you have to choose between a growing economy or democracy, or at least the appearance of either, that becomes a lot harder for people to decide on which is which. And we might like to think that people would say, well, democracy is always going to be better. But I think we're going to see over the next 5-10 years, in many places, we've always said it, see it in Turkey, you've seen it in places like Egypt, where you hope there's going to be more democracy and there isn't, that this is going to be a lot harder.
But the irony is, of course, that the economy is not even doing all that badly.
No, the economy is doing very well indeed, and employment rates are much...
No, but again, sorry, on this point, it's like it's then about what the appearance
is. Course.
Look, the economy in America is doing extremely well, particularly compared to 8 years ago. Barack Obama's administration has added 14 million jobs, unemployment has halved, GDP is growing. And yet, you hear Donald Trump today, and he talks about how the economy is a disaster, and how the factories have all closed, and all the jobs have gone. So,
well, there have been a lot of factories in the Rust Belt that have closed, and of course jobs have gone overseas, but overall the economy is doing well. I mean, there is a crisis, domestic crisis in the economy. I mean, if you're a manufacturer and your job's gone overseas, but
if you're a coal miner, you don't give a damn whether there's a new job in high tech in San Francisco. That does not help you.
That is
what needs to be persuaded, you know, happen, and that's another story for another day. But at the moment, you're listening to Midori House and me, Andrew Tuck, Steve Bloomfield and Danny Giacopelli. Coming up next, Melania, Don Jr., Eric, Ivanka. Just who are the first family?
A new year is upon us and a fresh issue of Monocle is hitting the newsstand. Eager to start the year as we mean to go on, we've packed the February issue full of ideas for how to make our cities and our lives healthier, smoother and, well, just better. In our 100th issue, we take a whistle-stop tour of three cities designed for healthy living, offer up some lessons, courtesy of a group of Dutch nuns, on how to learn a new foreign language, and we discover the smartest methods out there for making cities safer. The February issue of Monocle will have you shaking off any final vestiges of holiday slumber and sprinting into 2017 well-informed and suitably inspired. Monocle's February issue. Buy your copy today. Happy reading.
You're listening to Midori House, still with me, Steve Bloomfield and Daniel Giacopelli. As the Obamas make their way to a well-earned holiday in California, a new family is moving into the White House. The Trump clan were all but unknown a couple of years ago. Now they're set to become one of the most familiar set of faces in the world. Who are they and what can we expect? Danny.
Who do you want to know about first?
Well, what do you make of them as a team of people? Because
it's more of a company than a family.
Well, first of all, it's a company. And first of all, they're doing two interesting things. There is the role of course that Michelle Obama played, which is, you know, charitable, friendly face, the touchable image of the presidency, and that you think might fall to someone potentially like, I don't know, Ivanka, or maybe to Melania, but neither they often look great. And we should have said, you know, I think Melania was dressed by Ralph Lauren, I believe, today, and, you know, certainly looked the part of a first lady. But we haven't seen them be very good with crowds or with people. Do you think they're going to be able to do that outreach part that the family needs to do?
I think Melania will never really be seen again. I think she'll be wheeled out at official events, but I mean, really, she's going to play a minimal role in everything that happens the next 4 years, if they last 4 years. Ivanka, people have said she'll be the de facto first lady, although she's actually come out and said, the quote was, it's an inappropriate observation. There's one first lady, she'll do remarkable things. But really, Ivanka, I think, will be, you know, she'll be the family member you'll see most. People have said she might have an office in the White House. And she is really she's a nice woman, and she's a very smart woman, and she has a company of her own, and a lot of women like her, and she's kind of sociable. So can she play the role that, like, someone like Michelle Obama plays? No, I don't think so. But, I mean, she's not a terrible person.
Steve, on the political side, that's the thing that has kind of fascinated many people about this notion of nepotism and how close he'll be using his family. Jared Kushner is the most famous example of that. But is there anything wrong with that?
Well, there are two issues here. One is whether Jared Kushner, his son-in-law, should have a role in government. And to be honest, I'm quite torn on this. There are rules which say that he can't, although it seems to be they're a little bit vague when it comes to whether the president is allowed to have a son-in-law or a relative working with him. These were brought in after John F. Kennedy hired Bobby Kennedy as his attorney general. Now, you know, a lot of liberals will be very happy about, you know, Bobby Kennedy being part of JFK's cabinet. So, you know, is this really an issue? The nepotism and the conflicts of interest thing is far more important when it comes to the Trump business. And this whole idea that Trump is still going to have some sort of ownership of his business, that he won't speak to his sons at all about business, apparently, who will now be running it, which is just utterly unbelievable. When you look at all the potential deals that are happening around the world in other countries, with other influential figures, that's far more important than what Jared Kushner does or doesn't do in the White House.
Well, we're going to finish with another check-in from the US. Monocle's Thomas Lewis, the Welsh Wonder, is in Philadelphia. Thomas, the mood in the city?
We were promised some protests outside the City Hall here and various other points around the city. I'm looking out at the City Hall now and I can't really see anyone there. There is a big protest, a women's march again planned for Philadelphia tomorrow. They are expecting a lot of people to come to that. But I've spoken to quite a few people here who've been largely resigned, really, to today's sort of festivities. Philadelphia, of course, was probably the bluest part of Pennsylvania, which did, of course, itself go to Donald Trump. I went to a town called Lancaster last night, about an hour away from Philadelphia. Now, Lancaster County did vote for Donald Trump. And I was in this quite interesting little bar that had a quite equal split between Hillary Clinton voters and Donald Trump voters. And they were all getting on really pretty well. But when you spoke to the Trump supporters, things turned quite angry quite quickly. Just the very fact of asking kind of questions like what they wanted from their new president, that kind of thing, you know, suddenly became very defensive. And I thought that was quite interesting, that, you know, that is obviously something we've seen from Donald Trump pretty frequently so far, that whether that is sort of trickling down into, well, don't you question my judgment, this is what I've done, and you know, I'm very proud and I believe in it strongly. So yeah, it's quite a strange mood, I think. I think this notion of the nation divided, some of these people in this pub last night were quite keen to stress that they felt that the media was overblowing that slightly, and that actually, you know, even though they're on different sides of the political spectrum, that actually kind of day-to-day life, they still live happily sort of side by side.
And we don't have many seconds left, but just quickly tell me, you know, do people who you speak to on both sides of the divide think that things will change quickly over the coming days?
Neither side of the divide seems to know what's going to happen, to be totally honest. There's this almost kind of blind faith, I think, from Donald Trump's supporters that things will be good and things will be strong. There's a kind of resignation that they really are looking into a bit of an abyss, I think, for those who voted for Hillary Clinton. So I think there's a big question mark, whoever you voted for, frankly, whether you support him or not.
Danny, 5 seconds, last word.
I just wanted to say, if you want a reaction to the inauguration that sums up what just happened, the former KKK Grand Wizard David Duke tweeted, "We did it," after the inauguration. So there we are.
Well, Steve and Danny, thank you very much for joining us on this special edition of Midori House on the day that Donald Trump became the American president. And that's all we have time for. The show was produced by Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Well, it was produced by Tom Hall and researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and also by Alexis Sogul. And our studio manager was Kieran Banji. But from me, Andrew Tuck, thank you for listening. Have a good day and goodbye.